Clothes make the country. Today, Ukrainians are celebrating Vyshyvanka, decorative garments that tell the story of Ukraine's culture and heritage.
You know, with the war, too, we've seen people add elements of embroidering tanks, javelins, certain weapons that countries have given to Ukraine to fight.
Also on the show, a new day for women's cross-country skiing.
I have been waiting for this for about 30 years.
I'm Marco Werman, and we say goodbye to the hit British TV show, Derry Girls.
Catholics have more freckles.
Protestants hate ABBA.
A depiction of Northern Ireland during a tough time that went well beyond one-dimensional portrayals of war victims.
Or just idiots. You're fighting over nothing. Nothing's ever betrayed us as, like, actual real people.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In just over the past 2 years, the number of people at risk of starvation worldwide has more than doubled. The global food crisis has grown with the pandemic and, more recently, with the war in Ukraine. The UN is warning this week that without major action, this crisis could continue for years. Eric Munoz joins us to discuss. He's a senior policy advisor with Oxfam America. So, Eric, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is talking about tens of millions of people sliding into food insecurity. So how many people are we talking about at risk, and what parts of the world or countries are most vulnerable?
Well, Marco, the numbers are truly staggering. Last year, 193 million people were already suffering from acute hunger. And we know that the situation has just gotten much, much worse due to the conflict in Ukraine. But not only that, things like the economic slowdown and skyrocketing food prices have created an absolute humanitarian catastrophe.
The UN Secretary General is warning that global action is needed now, or this crisis will go on for years to come. So what can be done to prevent that? What can one organization like Oxfam or the World Food Program actually do?
So we are providing food, water, shelter, medical care, just the basic necessities that people need to survive. And we're aiming to reach 1.5 million people over the next several months. But more than 40 million people are in need of assistance. So globally, what's required now is, one, aid agencies need the resources to get food and medical care to people in need now. That means international donors need to step up with the financial resources to make that possible. Two, we also need to make sure that farmers and pastoralists can recover. People in rural areas who rely on agriculture for their own food needs are the ones who've been hardest hit. Unless they have the seeds, the fertilizer, the restocking of livestock to recover, they will simply remain in a spiral of hunger.
Do the food supplies exist globally?
This is not a problem of food availability. There is enough food available everywhere. Certainly high food prices or breaks in export supplies from countries like Ukraine or Russia. But the food is out there. It needs to be moved, and it needs to be moved efficiently to the places of need. And we need to make sure that countries don't take actions that would stop food from getting to where it needs quickly.
So I was really struck by statistics I read in The Guardian. And Ukraine provides 12% of the planet's wheat, 15% of its corn, and half of its sunflower oil. India recently stopped export of its wheat because of the need. So which countries have responded with help, and what are they actually doing?
So just today, the U.S. is actually debating a bill to provide $5 billion of additional aid. But all donors need to play their part, including non-traditional donors who have not in the past provided large amounts of humanitarian funding, like the Gulf countries. And we're also looking to the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and others to provide financing where they have some flexibility to do so. We need everyone to crowd in and provide aid now.
With all these extenuating circumstances, how different is this crisis from other moments of food insecurity?
In other moments when we've had high levels of food insecurity or hunger, we often see one or two drivers pushing the situation. Here, we've seen a confluence of factors that are multi-year in their scope. Economic slowdown because of COVID, conflict, successive droughts in some places, and other climate-induced weather extremes that have destroyed crops. And then on top of all of this, food prices and inflation. It's not just one factor this year, it's multiple. And we're concerned that this is not going to end next season, but it'll be multiple years before we come out on the other side of this.
I mean, have you heard any stories that illustrate where things are at right now?
In Somalia, Oxfam spoke with one woman, Hafsa, who had left her home and walked miles with her two children in search of food. She reported to us that she had only two goats of the 150 that had formerly been in her herd. The rest had perished. And she moved because she had no hope, no opportunity, no source of food or water. What's so concerning is that her story is not unique. We are seeing the story play out over and over again where we're responding.
Eric Munoz is a senior policy advisor with Oxfam America. He's been speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it, Eric.
Good to be with you.
Across Ukraine today, people are celebrating Vyshyvanka Day. The Vyshyvanka is one of the best-known symbols of Ukrainian culture, a traditional shirt or dress elaborately embroidered and found across Ukraine, as well as in some neighboring countries. Ukrainian-American reporter Lydia Tomku celebrates Vyshyvanka Day and joins us now from New York. So are you dressed for the occasion, Lydia? And if you are, describe what garment you've got on for Vyshyvanka Day.
Yes, I am wearing a beautiful modern Vyshyvanka today on linen, and it has beautiful black large flowers on it. And it's from a brand in Kyiv called Etnodim. And President Zelensky's wife actually wore one of their shirts a few years ago on Vyshyvanka Day herself.
Oh, no kidding. So I'm guessing the garment itself will be different for men and women, but how much does the embroidery change?
Yeah, Vyshyvanka comes from the Ukrainian word vyshyvate, which means to embroider, to sew. And it's a tradition that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years in Ukraine. And they're deeply full of meaning. So you're going to see different colors, symbols, patterns. You'll see animals and plants. Regions of Ukraine that have a more Mediterranean climate, for example, you'll see grapes sewn onto them.
Huh.
To symbolize kind of the nature and bounty of that region of Ukraine. And the patterns are really different across the country. My grandmothers were both avid embroiderers, so they would do all kinds of different patterns, a lot of geometric ones as well. They would make me beautiful outfits for Easter and Christmas. And there's always a little bit of whimsy and fun with them too. My mom sent me a photo of me in a winter coat from the early 90s, and my grandmother had embroidered some little chipmunks on it for fun, along with some traditional patterns.
And how is the day celebrated in Ukraine and diaspora communities abroad?
Yeah, Vyshyvanka Day is a pretty recent holiday, actually. There's been a real resurgence in wearing Vyshyvanka, especially after the 2014 Euromaidan revolution. And they're a way to celebrate Ukraine's culture and heritage. You're going to see a lot of people on the hashtag Vyshyvanka Day showing what they're wearing. And, you know, I think this year, especially since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine on February 24th, a lot of people are embracing heritage and culture. And, you know, with the war, too, we've seen people add elements of embroidering tanks, javelins, certain weapons that countries have given to Ukraine to fight. So it's really part of Ukraine's storytelling, history, and culture and tradition.
Yeah, I mean, with Ukraine fighting a war with Russia, a war that for Russia is partly about co-opting Ukrainian culture, I mean, how does that change the way you look, how Ukrainians look at the holiday this year?
Yeah, for me, I think I feel very lucky that I've always had beautiful embroidery in my family, done by my grandmothers, in my own family. And I just think it's important to celebrate a beautiful element of culture in what is a very difficult time for many Ukrainians in Ukraine and abroad.
I mean, it is an old tradition, Vyshyvanka, but as you said, it's a relatively new celebration. What prompted it back in the 2000s?
It was actually students who started it, and it just kind of spread. And, you know, even today you're seeing President Zelensky with a video message greeting the people of Ukraine with this day.
Сильна, незламна, смілива і вільна. З Днем Вишиванки, Україну.
He's wearing a lovely Vyshyvanka that's green, and it looks like it has elements of oak trees, a strong, you know, tree, a strong symbol on his shirt. So it's just a holiday that's now really been embraced across both, you know, everyday people and politicians and celebrities in Ukraine.
You spoke earlier, Lydia, about your grandmothers and their embrace of Vyshyvanka. What have these patterns, this embroidery, meant to them and to your family?
I think for them, having left Ukraine in 1945 and come to the U.S., it was a way for them to preserve history and culture in a foreign country, in a different place where they settled and had their lives. And it was a way for them to pass on in our families these beautiful embroideries and this heritage and this culture. And I am just so very lucky that I have so many of these shirts, so many of these beautiful roshnike and tablecloths that I'm going to be able to pass on in my own family.
Reporter Lydia Tomku is Ukrainian-American, telling us about Vyshyvanka Day, a holiday celebrated today across Ukraine and across the Ukrainian diaspora. Thank you very much, Lydia.
Thanks for having me.
European leaders want to fully face the wind, trying to turn the North Sea into Europe's green power plant. At a summit yesterday, Denmark's climate and energy minister said the Vikings have already given them the roadmap to get there.
Not fight each other, though, but collaborate on doing what they did. Finding new ways of harvesting the wind.
Finn Mortensen knows what it will take to do this again. He's executive director of State of Green, a nonprofit environmental branding organization based in Copenhagen. Finn, what was the purpose of this European Union summit in Denmark, and what four countries were represented there?
The four countries represented were Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Denmark. The heads of state of the four countries decided on a historical agreement, you really could call it, to provide a total of about 150 gigawatt of offshore wind, six times the world's current wind capacity at sea. So the figures really speak for themselves.
So pledging to build 150 gigawatts of offshore energy over the next few decades, what does that mean in practical terms? Like, how many homes could that power?
When everything is installed, it will provide electricity to up to 230 million European households, which is more or less half of the total population in Europe. It is enormous figures.
Mm. And the summit was hosted in Denmark. How has Denmark used offshore wind?
Well, I think you could call it symbolic. Denmark was the birthplace of offshore wind technology. We built the first offshore wind farm more than 30 years ago. So over the years, we have gained a lot of experience. We actually today boast some of the world's leading wind developers and tech providers in wind.
So these North Sea countries, Germany, Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, those are the ones represented at the summit. What other countries in Europe could benefit from wind power that don't have access to the North Sea?
Well, you have a number of European countries that are landlocked, and they definitely also would benefit. Obviously, this will require a lot of infrastructure, not only to build the thousands of wind turbines needed, but also to get the electricity onshore and get the system working across European borders. And that's why it's so important also that the infrastructure part of it has also been discussed in the various countries.
So here in the U.S., as you may know, there are a lot of objections, often NIMBY, not in my backyard objections, to offshore wind. It'll destroy sight lines or harm birds. Do those concerns exist in Denmark?
To a certain extent, yes, but several opinion polls have showed that more than 90% of the population is actually in favor of wind power. And these wind farms we're talking about here, they will be out in the North Sea, far away from the coastal line, so you won't be able to see them. It's a pride to most people that we are able to have not only set a path for wind power globally, but also been the first, as I said, to install offshore wind power.
What other obstacles do you think there might be in meeting this goal by 2050, like supply chain issues or bureaucratic red tape?
I think if you look at the situation today, we have problems with the supply chain, not least because of the war in Ukraine, but there are also other reasons for the supply chain problems, and we need to solve them in the future, no doubt. Red tape could also be an issue. However, at least in Denmark, the government has been favorable towards the wind industry, trying to ease the regulations and speed up the processes for giving permissions to put up wind turbines, not only offshore, but also on land.
Finn Mortensen is executive director of State of Green, a nonprofit environmental branding organization. He's been speaking with us from Copenhagen, Denmark. Finn, thank you very much. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Winter sports may not be top of mind right now, but here's an interesting item from the world of cross-country skiing. The International Ski Federation, or FIS, has ruled that men and women competing in World Cup cross-country ski races will now race the same distances. Those distances can be up to 50 kilometers or 30 miles. The impetus for change did not come from a Nordic nation that dominates the sport. It came from the United States and Molly Peters, who organized the effort. She cross-country ski raced through high school and college and is currently the Nordic ski coach at St. Michael's College in Vermont. So, Molly, what's your reaction to the decision of the International Ski Federation?
I have been waiting for this for about 30 years since my college coach brought it up to me when I was racing, and she was fighting for it. And then I sort of took over 10 years ago when I started coaching. You know, we just always just ran up against a wall whenever we brought it up. So it was shocking that it finally has passed.
Before we go on, what are the current distances for men and women at the World Cup level? And what are the new ones that will be for both men and women?
So typically, both men and women had been doing the sprints, but most of the time they were equal. And then the women would race 10 kilometers or 6 miles, and the men would do 15 kilometers or around 9 miles for their middle distance races. And then the longer distance races, women would do 30 kilometers or about 20 miles, and the men would do 50 kilometers, which is about 30 miles.
And now it's all evened up to the men's distance?
It actually was a compromise. So now they will be doing primarily 10-kilometer races, 20-kilometer races, and then 50-kilometer races for both genders.
So the men will come down in distance?
Yes, in the middle distance, and then the women will go up to the 50K for the longer distance race.
Were there detractors on equalizing the distance between men and women, and what were their arguments?
There were a lot of detractors. I mean, it was pretty amazing the things that I would hear. You know, at first it was just would just take too long for the women to do the men's races. The poor volunteers would be out there, you know, in the snow. And then as people sort of started to come around, it became more, the biggest detractor was that it was not standardized at the international level. So, and they thought that maybe women and men should race the same amount of time, but not the same distance.
Well, as you know, Scandinavia is the heart and soul of cross-country skiing or Nordic skiing. Was there much support there among women racers, both current and former?
Well, it was really interesting. I actually just read an article this morning, and it quoted many of the Norwegian women, and they were all just, they didn't feel like this was the right move, which, you know, it's hard to believe, but it's true. They didn't want to see the equalization of race distances.
Given that the men's distance will also be affected, I'm wondering if any men oppose the change.
It's been really interesting throughout this whole process. I feel like I've had more support from the men's side of things than the women's side of things. And, you know, I have sort of my theories on why that happens. I think the women were really afraid that they would just have to do the men's distances, and that didn't seem fair, but it seems like they've done a really good job compromising. As well as I think, you know, you like what you're good at. So, you know, the women had these distances that they were extremely successful in, and then they're being told that it might change. And that doesn't really, nobody likes change, right? It doesn't feel good. But I had Bill Koch, who's like the Nordic skier from the US, won a medal back in the 70s. I mean, he was on board with my proposal. Jessie Diggins, I mean, she's the biggest thing in Nordic skiing right now in the world. And she signed on. And I think between the two of them, that was the clincher.
Molly Peters is a former cross-country ski competitor and is currently the Nordic ski coach at St. Michael's College in Vermont. Molly, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Fans, and that includes me, are bidding adieu to the hit show Derry Girls. The last episode of its third and final season aired on TV in the UK last night. The show tells the story of a group of teenagers living in the small Northern Ireland city of Derry in the mid-1990s, the last years of the troubles between Protestants and Catholics. For fans from Northern Ireland, the show's success comes from its uncanny ability to tell a story that prioritizes comedy and daily life over bloodshed. Reporter Rebecca Rossman has more.
Shauna Malloy always rolled her eyes at the overdramatic portrayals of her home of Northern Ireland.
The way we're portrayed is either as sort of, you know, blighted victims of a terrible war, or just idiots who are fighting over nothing. Nothing's ever betrayed us as like actual real people.
So when friends encouraged her to watch a new show called Derry Girls back in 2018, she hesitated, but eventually caved in.
The first reaction was the accents didn't make me want to throw the TV out the window.
Set in the same era when Malloy herself was growing up, Derry Girls doesn't ignore the daily realities of bomb threats and machine guns. But the show is told through the perspective of five teens whose biggest priorities aren't bombs, but rather boys, dreams, and getting into all kinds of mischief.
Teenagers have rights now, you know.
Don't be ridiculous.
They do, Ma. It's true. Sure, Macaulay Culkin might be divorced and has parents.
That's Aaron, the angsty, ambitious dreamer. And then there's Orla, her space cadet cousin, the high-strung studious Claire, and then James.
Well, come on then, Bob. Are you introducing yourself or what?
Hi, I'm Michelle's cousin, James.
Why is he making that funny noise?
He's English, Orla. That's the way they talk.
He's the wee English fella who inevitably becomes the butt of all jokes. And Michelle, the brash one with a filthy mouth.
What rhymes with ride?
Bide.
Bide. What the f*** does bide mean? Bide? That's not a word.
It is a word, Michelle.
Bide. You've pure made that up.
Everyone went to school with a Michelle in Ireland, basically.
Tanya Sweeney is a columnist and features writer for the Irish Independent. She applauds the show's creator, Lisa McGee, for her sharp writing, attention to detail, and above all, ability to tell a story that resonates.
Teenagers just didn't care. I mean, I have friends who went into Belfast on Saturday mornings. Their bags were checked by soldiers. But they didn't care because they had to get into town to buy the top that they wanted for that night.
Then there's the scenes taken from real life, like in this episode, when Catholic and Protestant students meet for a special Friends Across the Barricade weekend trip and are given this activity in front of a blackboard.
I want you guys to give me examples of things that Catholics and Protestants have in common. And things that they don't have in common. Let's start with similarities.
Issue is, they can only come up with differences.
Catholics watch RTE.
Protestants love clean air.
Protestants are taller.
Catholics have more freckles.
Protestants hate ABBA.
Okay, thank you.
It was just so well observed.
Sarah Dorman lives in London, but is originally from a suburb just outside Belfast. She remembers participating in her own Friends Across the Barricade trip in high school.
Things like Protestants keep their toasters in the cupboard, that is very Northern Irish, and it is, people do say that, and I'm from a Protestant community, my mum does keep her toaster in the cupboard.
The show has only lasted 3 seasons, with 6 20-minute episodes each, but it's attracted an international cult following. Here's Tanya Sweeney from the Irish Independent again.
The fact that it has resonated with American audiences has just really bowled me over, and I've sought to kind of figure out why that might be. And, you know, like I say, it's the humour. It's the universality. It's just so animated.
In other words, you don't have to be from Derry to be a Derry girl. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman.
We'll be right back with more. You're listening to The World. In West Africa, in Ghana, many school children are going hungry. The caterers who cook at home for them are on strike and say between inflation and low wages, they can't afford to deliver meals to the schools.
Transportation now is on the high cost. Gas is on the high. Everything is on the high. We can't cook. That is what we want the government to know.
Ghana's food insecurity problem still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For 83 days, Ukrainian soldiers at the Azovstal steel mill in the port city of Mariupol held off a relentless Russian bombardment. On Monday, hundreds of those Ukrainian fighters emerged from the plant and surrendered. Russian officials are describing the defeat as a turning point in the war. Ukrainian officials hope it's a prelude to a prisoner exchange. Kira Rudik is a member of Ukraine's parliament and leader of the Holos Party. She monitored the Azovstal negotiations closely and joins us from Kyiv. Ms. Rudik, what's next for the more than 200 Ukrainian troops who were evacuated and sent to Olenivka, a town under Russian control? Do you know anything about how they're being treated?
Right now, we are still in process of making sure that the Red Cross and United Nations organizations, that they do enforce and ensure the defenders of Azovstal are treated with respect, and most of all, that they are safe and they are receiving the medical support that they were transported for. So we do not have official report yet, but we do know that so far things are okay.
There were 50 fighters who were described as seriously injured and were evacuated to another Ukrainian town near the Russian border. It's called Novoazovsk. Are you convinced that they are receiving the medical care they need?
The main reason for leaders of the defenders to agree on extraction of people from the besieged Mariupol and the Azovstal was that people were seriously injured and had really wounds that wouldn't let them last long. So that's why it was an agreement with the United Nations and the Red Cross that they would ensure and be the guarantors that people will receive the medical help and that they will be safe.
As I said, Ms. Rudik, you are in Kyiv. How are you getting accurate information from an area under Russian control?
So we are getting information from representatives of international peace organizations. We are getting information from some of our soldiers who are able to get to the cell phone, which is extremely hard. And we are getting information from our security services.
So Russia has called these prisoners Nazi war criminals, and the Russian Supreme Court might declare them terrorists. That would give Moscow cover to deprive the prisoners of war their rights. Does that worry you?
Of course that does. You know, we have been at war with Russia for 8 years before. We know all their tips and tricks. But you know, there is another thing. I have a friend. She has her boyfriend as a wounded soldier here in Azovstal. And I talk to her every single day. And what she tells me is, I want to pray to God, let them do whatever they want to him. I want him alive. I want him to come back. I want all our plans to get married, to have kids, to build a house. I want all of them to come true. So just get them out. And you know how many wives and girlfriends and loved ones are throughout Ukraine who are praying right now for the lives of the soldiers there.
What hope is there of a prisoner exchange?
The original idea is that as soon as the wounded soldiers are transportable and so that they would be exchanged as soon as possible. However, there are those risks that Russia wouldn't keep their part of the deal.
Also, news today in a courtroom in Kyiv, a 21-year-old tank commander pleaded guilty to killing an unarmed 62-year-old Ukrainian civilian. He said to the victim's widow, "I acknowledge my blame. I ask you to forgive me." Now, the Kremlin said it was not able to provide any legal assistance to this Russian tank commander. What's the purpose of this sort of trial?
For us, it's the first step of this same tribunal as Hitler had and all the members of Hitler's regime in Nuremberg. And it's extremely important that we started something, and today was a good start.
Nuremberg, however, happened after the war and was a massive global process. This is a trial that starts while the war is happening. Does that make a difference in your view?
Yeah, it does. But for Nuremberg to happen, the whole world needed to unite and destroy Nazi Germany. Right now, I hope that we went farther than that. It was 80 years saying never again, that we were able to do some things in parallel.
Ms. Rudick, are you worried that this tank commander's trial will encourage Russians to hold similar trials for their Ukrainian prisoners of war?
No matter what we do, they will be going with their plan. Given the nature of democracy, we are reactive here. We are thinking 10 times, should we annoy the dictator? We are thinking, are we obeying all the rules? The possibility of the similar trials in Russia have zero correlation with what's happening in Ukraine.
Analysts are worried about how long this war could go on. Are you concerned that negotiations to end the war seem to have collapsed?
Well, I never believed in negotiations in the first place. I'm a strong opponent of agreeing with Putin on anything because we have seen for 8 years that he is not going to keep his part of the bargain. And the only good way to ensure that he can execute on anything is to make sure that we have a security guarantees. And right now, there is no security guarantees.
Kira Rudik is a member of Ukraine's parliament and leader of the Holos Party. She joined us from Kyiv. Ms. Rudik, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and glory to Ukraine.
In Colombia, there's a tectonic shift underway right now. For decades, political parties on the right dominated the country. But now, if the polls are correct and Gustavo Petro wins the upcoming election, he would become Colombia's very first left-wing president. But the real breakout star in this election might be Petro's running mate.
Buenas tardes, Cauca.
Francia Márquez has been attracting massive crowds on the campaign trail.
Y aquí tienen a su vicepresidenta.
Márquez could become the first black person and first woman elected vice president in Colombia. From Bogota, the world's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, brings us her story.
Francia Márquez gave a big speech in her hometown just a few days ago.
Yo también les amo Cauca. Yo también amo a mi país.
She told them, "I love you too, Cauca," the name of her region along Colombia's Pacific coast. Wearing a gold-colored dress and her afro in a bun, she said she'd heard people complain she was campaigning everywhere except there.
Bueno, pues aquí estoy dándole la cara a mi pueblo, a mi departamento.
Well, here I am showing my face to my people, Márquez told the crowd.
Así que hay de ustedes y no voten, pues.
With a laugh, she added, "If you don't vote, that's up to you." Indeed, Francia Márquez has been campaigning all over Colombia, getting lots of attention. She has no experience in elected office, and yet in the presidential primary this March, she was the third highest vote getter, ahead of many veteran politicians. And her origins in the Cauca region tell a personal story of living with violence that resonates with many across Colombia. Márquez, who's 40, began speaking out as a teenager against multinational corporations seeking to exploit a river that runs through her community, the Ovejas River. Why was the Río Ovejas so important for you personally?
Porque yo desde los cinco años.
In an interview, Márquez tells me that virtually everyone in her community grew up bathing, fishing, and panning for gold in the Ovejas River. The historically black community where she comes from is called La Toma. It's a place where most people get by on small-scale gold mining. Over several years, Márquez and others pleaded with local officials or through the courts to stop efforts to divert the Ovejas River. Frustrated, in 2014, Márquez led a group of women walking almost 400 miles through the Andean Mountains to the capital of Bogotá. They staged a sit-in for 4 days at the Interior Ministry.
Estamos cansadas y no aguantamos más.
In an improvised speech, Márquez told officials that they were tired of fighting.
Así nos toque con nuestra vida, pero vamos a garantizar que nuestros hijos, que nuestras hijas.
Even if it costs us our lives, Márquez said, we won't stop until we guarantee our children's right to safely live on our land. After the sit-in, the heavy machinery digging through the Ovejas River was forced out. And around that time, Márquez received death threats against her and her two sons. It became the first, but not last time they would be displaced from their home.
La impotencia era total porque hacíamos un acuerdo en una movilización, nosotros estábamos contentas.
Márquez tells me she felt powerless. She says Colombian authorities would promise to protect her community's rights, and then they wouldn't do enough to stop legal or illegal efforts to exploit the land.
Y pues eso me hizo dar conciencia como, bueno, es que si seguimos esperando que esta gente cambie algo, nunca lo va a cambiar. ¿No?
I realized that if we wait on the government's promises, nothing will change, Márquez says. She continued to work on her community's property rights from afar, and she cleaned homes to pay for law school in the city of Cali. A few years later, she received international recognition.
Sabemos que los territorios donde hemos construido comunidad y recreado nuestra cultura.
Márquez won the prestigious Goldman Environmental Prize for grassroots activism.
Soy parte de un proceso, de una historia de lucha y resistencia que empezó con mis ancestros.
In her acceptance speech, Márquez said she was part of a resistance movement that began centuries ago when her ancestors were removed from Africa and enslaved. She said she was part of a long fight for liberty, justice, and dignity.
No es fácil en un país que usa la violencia. No es fácil en
It's not easy in a country where violence is so common, Márquez tells me. Colombia is one of the deadliest countries for community activists. 145 were killed last year, according to government figures. And now that Márquez is potentially one step away from becoming vice president, her life continues to be in danger. You've received numerous threats throughout your career, and you post some of these threats on your social media, and the language that they use is, I would describe it as chilling. How has that affected your personal life? How have you had to adapt to that?
Pues ha sido duro, pero ya estamos cansados de eso.
Márquez says it's been difficult and that she is tired. She says she sent both of her sons out of the country and that she stopped going back to her own home and sleeps somewhere different every night. She says she wants to be part of the change so she and other Colombians will no longer have to live in fear.
Why do you think that you'll be different from the politicians that you met in your community, that you'll make promises and you actually follow through with them?
No, porque sé lo que se siente, porque sé que eso es miserable.
Márquez tells me that she will be different because she knows from personal experience that not keeping promises is a miserable thing to do. And she says, because she knows who she is and where she came from. For the world, I'm Jorge Valencia, Bogotá, Colombia.
Ghana in West Africa is classified as a middle-income country, and yet right now, 2.5 million people there do not have enough to eat, technically severely food insecure. A quarter of all child mortality cases in Ghana are due to malnutrition, and there are fears that record-level inflation and high food and transportation costs could make these statistics even worse. This month, caterers who work for Ghana's national school meal program have stopped delivering food. From Ghana's capital, Accra, Ridwan Karim Dini Osman reports.
Hundreds of pupils of the Nima cluster of schools in Accra dash out of their classrooms as the tolling of the school bell signifies break time. Usually, around this time, they enjoy free lunch, rice and stew, typically from the National School Feeding Program. But today, the caterers are absent and pupils like 9-year-old Frederick Anaba are having a tough time in school.
Teacher said teaching, I cannot concentrate because my stomach will be paining me.
This is because caterers of the program are currently on an indefinite strike to protest unpaid arrears, plus inadequate feeding grants amid a rising cost of living. Samuel Amponsa is a teacher at the Nima cluster of schools. He says the strike is hampering effective academic work.
The school feeding program enables the student to show up at school preparedly. But since the caterer stopped cooking, we've seen more absenteeism.
Nearly 4 million children in over 10,000 public schools rely on the feeding program to meet their nutritional needs. The program was launched in 2005 with the goal of alleviating poverty and enhancing food security in Ghana. The aim is also to boost domestic food production by sourcing raw materials locally and providing a sustainable market for local food producers in the community. However, food prices in Ghana have more than tripled this year. Transportation costs have also gone through the roof. The caterers each have independent contracts with the government. They want the government to raise the current daily feeding grant from 97 pesos, or the equivalent of 12 cents, to about 39 cents per child. They also want the over $30 million owed them paid as soon as possible. Helena Apia is the general secretary to the Ghana School Feeding Caterers Association.
We cook the food from our various homes before we convey it to the various schools. Even transportation now, as we speak, is on the high cost. Gas is on the high. Everything is on the high. We can't cook with 97 pesos. That is what we want the government to know.
Apia says some of their members had gone for loans to provide food for the children and are at the moment being harassed by their creditors. She says several meetings with the government over the matter have come to naught.
Nothing good came out of the meeting. They said they can't help us. They are not in capacity to help us. So our decision is no increment, no cooking.
According to UNICEF, around the world, more than 39 billion in-school meals have already been missed globally since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic due to school closures. And in Ghana, those meals are crucial. Almost 2 in 3 children between 6 months and 2 years of age are not fed food that supports their rapidly growing bodies and brains. This puts them at risk of poor brain development, low immunity, increased infections, and in many cases, death. Child rights advocate Vera Elikem Awoye says the current situation is a threat to the overall well-being and development of many vulnerable children.
We need to be expanding the school feeding program and not stifling it.
In many poor countries, the promise of a meal can be enough to make struggling parents send their daughter to school, allowing her to escape hazardous work or early marriage.
I think that the government should reach a consensus with these caterers, provide them with the resources for them to provide quality food, nutritional food for these children, and so that these children can grow more healthy, stay in school, and become the future that we really want to see.
The school feeding secretariat says steps are being fast-tracked to resolve the concerns. head of communications for the secretariat, Siba Alpha, urged the caterers to return to work, but failed to give timelines as to when a solution will be found.
So no money is here at the secretariat. So we have told them that we are still following up the money from the Controller and Accountant General Department. They should be assured that everything is being done possible to ensure that payment is paid.
Back at the school, pupils continue to wait with bated breath for the return of their long-cherished hot meals. And for those who solely depend on it, it will save them from hunger pangs. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
This weekend, Australia will choose its next prime minister. The matchup pits incumbent Scott Morrison versus the challenger Anthony Albanese. And when the topic of who's tougher on China comes up, get out the popcorn.
I think we're getting more questions between the two of you than our panel.
No authority whatsoever. This is a very important point. I'm sorry. This is a very important point.
You're making more points. No, Mr. Morrison, Mr. Albanese, that's enough.
Good luck making sense of that. Jennifer Sue, though, can make sense of it. She's a research fellow at the Lowy Institute, an international policy think tank based in Sydney. Jennifer just heard the two top candidates for Australian Prime Minister getting pretty hot under the collar about China. Explain why China evokes such strong emotions in Australian politics right now.
Well, first of all, during the election campaign, Solomon Islands and China signed a security deal, which has many in Canberra concerned and anxious about the possibility of a naval base being built in the Solomon Islands, which is only 2,000 kilometres away from Australia. So that's number one. But over the last 5 years, we've seen bilateral relations between Australia and China deteriorate quite significantly to the point where there are no high-level diplomatic dialogues between Beijing and Canberra, which is very problematic given how important China is to Australia's economy. So I think the state of bilateral relations, the anxiety over the security deal between the Chinese and Solomon Islands, these have all exacerbated nerves in Australia and particularly during the election campaign.
I mean, even before the Solomon Islands Pact, we know the tension between China and Australia goes back years. What are the roots of that contentious relationship?
So the roots of that contentious relationship probably starts with the broader foreign interference debate that occurred in Australia since 2015, 2016, where a member of the Labour Party, Sam Dastyari, the politician, resigned publicly, saying that he had been influenced by someone close to the Chinese Communist Party. So that triggered a series of events leading to the government introducing the Foreign Interference Bill. We know that the Chinese Communist Party is very active in recruiting and engaging with ethnic Chinese outside of China. And so as a result of the resignation of Sam Dastyari, really put China in the focus of Australia's political debate.
I mean, that's a very specific moment, you taking us back to 2015. Before that, how would you characterize Australian-Chinese relations?
You know, the mid-2010s and before that, we were probably at a golden point or golden era of Australia-China relations. Trade was flowing on both sides, China being such an important market for so many of Australia's goods. And so there was a lot of people-to-people exchanges, trade was flowing, and there were obviously ministerial dialogues. That stopped when the Prime Minister of Australia called for a international investigation into the origins of the COVID pandemic. And so over the last 2-3 years, there's been no contact between Canberra and Beijing at the high level, ministerial level.
And as far as the recent security deal China struck with the Solomon Islands, I mean, the West has been trying to counteract China's growing influence across the globe. Doesn't it make sense that Australia would position itself as a bulwark against China too, on China's doorstep?
One of the things that China is very effective in doing is to throw money at small island states to garner their support. Australia doesn't have that leverage and doesn't prosecute its interests in the region in that way. It can't compete with money politics, essentially. So there's only so much Australia can do when squaring off with China.
So, Jennifer, aside from the Solomon Islands controversy, what are the other main issues related to Australia-China relations?
Sure. So in the last 5 years, we've seen increased racism and discrimination targeted at Chinese Australians, in part because of the public narrative around China. Early on in the souring of the relationships, there was very little difference that was made between China, Chinese party state, the Chinese government, and people of ethnic Chinese heritage. All that was wrapped into one, and there was very little differentiation. But we know that people of Chinese heritage are not to be equated with the Communist Party of China. The ethnic Chinese population is large, but that's not to say they have all come recently from the PRC. At the start of COVID pandemic, we saw an increase in discrimination and racism targeted towards Chinese Australians, but broadly Asian Australians. And so in our Lowy Institute Being Chinese in Australia poll, people have reported over the last 12 months that they have been targets of physical abuse and threat. And that number, 18%, of Chinese Australians have been reported that hasn't really budged at all. And that presents worrying trends for Australia's social cohesion.
Do you think this election could point to any improvement in relations between China and Australia?
So should the Labor Party win on Saturday, we might see a softer tone in terms of how Canberra addresses Beijing. There may be more willingness on the side of Beijing to talk to Australia or pick up the phone, as they say. I think in terms of the Labor Party's emphasis on diplomacy may be the key with the Labor Party. If they do win, the foreign minister will very likely be Senator Penny Wong, who is of ethnic Chinese heritage, and that will have symbolic importance as well.
Jennifer Su is a research fellow at the Lowy Institute's Public Opinion and Foreign Policy Program based in Sydney. Jennifer, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the program, Marco.
Well, the political parties may be duking it out down under, but when it comes to music, two of the biggest and longest running acts in Australia, it's all about teamwork. The electronic hip-hop duo Hermitude have been together since 2000, longer if you count the time they were making music together in their early teens. Then there's the Jungle Giants, an indie rock band from Brisbane, together since 2011. Their collaboration with Hermitude gives us this song, When You Feel Like This. Hermitude says they wanted to put out a feel-good vibe. When You Feel Like This was written mid-pandemic, and the band wanted to bring, they say, a bit of positivity to burst through the bleakness of the time. So we leave you today with a dose of that positivity. For more than a dose, remember, whether it's new music from Oz or anywhere, we've got your music cravings and curiosity covered. We have a playlist with artists featured on the show so far this year. Find a link to it on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. Thank you as always for listening.